Thank you so very much. I want you to turn to John chapter 6. And I want to ask you a question. Is anybody here under any pressure? Anybody? When I drove by where I used to live as a student here, I began to think about the pressure that I was under when I was a student. There are a lot of you here today, and you're under pressure. I'm under pressure. How do you think it is? What do you think it's like to preach in front of Dr. Moeller? You don't think that's pressure? Every illustration you use, he knows where you got it. Every quote you give, he knows whether or not it's accurate. Every statistic you give, he knows whether or not it's right. He's the only man I know that reads books before they're written. I mean, it's an incredible thing. And by the way, Dr. Aiken, thank you for wearing socks today. Thank you so much. I want to talk to you today about pressure because everybody knows, if you go to the seminary, what pressure's like. Many of you pastor small country churches. You've got families to support. You've got Greek and Hebrew to parse. You've got theology to study. You've got exams coming up. You've got children to feed. You've got people pulling at you and tugging at you. You don't have any free moment to yourself. And as I was thinking yesterday and praying through what I wanted to preach, I said, Lord, I want to touch these students where they are. And so I put myself back where you were. And let me just tell you a couple of things, not to discourage you, but just to warn you. Every psychological study ever done says that one of the three most stress-filled professions in America is the ministry. Now, let me tell you some worse news. Once you get out of here, it doesn't get any better. You have to deal with deacons. Some of you have to deal with WMU. You have to deal with the cantankerous church members. Let me just go ahead and give you a little piece of advice. I want to help you out. This will be worth coming for. Don't ever read anonymous mail. You'll never get an anonymous letter that's encouraging. Take my word for it. I'm telling you right now. I like what Yogi Berra said. Yogi Berra said, I never answer anonymous mail. And I'm telling you, all it does is add pressure. And in John chapter 6, I want to share with you a pressure-packed situation. The disciples were with Jesus. They were facing a crowd, John said, of 5,000 men. That does not include the women and the children. They were hungry. Now, Jesus goes to Philip, and he asks Philip a question in verse 5. Where shall we buy that these may eat? Let me stop and ask you a question. They're looking at a minimum, maybe 10,000 people. And Jesus comes to Philip and said, Philip, where are we going to buy bread for these people to eat? Do you think Philip felt any pressure at that point in his life? Jesus comes to him and says, where are we going to buy bread? Now, what is so interesting is Jesus already knew what he was going to do, but Philip didn't have a clue what he was going to do. And by the way, let me just give you a word of encouragement. And I hope you'll get a lot of tidbits of encouragement in this message. When you ever get to the point and you're going to find yourself in this situation, so many times as a pastor and so many times as a minister of music or a minister of education or a missionary or what have you, you're going to be in times in your life when you don't know what to do. And let me give you the good news. When you don't know what to do, Jesus does. When you don't know what to do, Jesus does. Sometimes you're going to be in the situation of a little boy who was standing on his tiptoes trying to ring a doorbell, and he was trying so hard to reach that doorbell, and he just couldn't do it. And an old man was walking by with a cane and couldn't barely walk, but he saw the plight of that little boy, and so he walked up the path to this house, and he said, here, son, let me ring that doorbell for you. So he rung it, looked at the little boy, and said, now what do we do? And the little boy said, run. That's what I'm going to do. Now, there may be times that you don't know what to do, but Jesus knows what to do. So if you're under pressure this morning, I want you to understand why God allows pressure to come into your life. There are three things I want you to jot down this morning, and always remember them. The next time you're going to a hot business meeting or a hot deacon's meeting, or you've got a hot one-on-one meeting with somebody that thinks they know more about how to run your life and pastor your church than you do, and you know it's going to be a pressure-packed meeting. And you ask yourself, why do I do this? Why do I allow myself? Why did I even bother to get into the ministry to begin with? I want you to remember what God's trying to do with pressure. Number one, pressure tests our faith in Jesus. Pressure tests our faith in Jesus. Now, every miracle that Jesus performed was a mighty miracle. But there's several things very unique about this miracle. Number one, it is the only miracle mentioned in all four Gospels. The only miracle that Jesus ever performed that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all recorded was this miracle. Number two, it is the only miracle where Jesus ever asked the advice of another person before he performed the miracle. Number three, it is the only time that Jesus ever performed a type of miracle like this before such a huge crowd. Now, Jesus had traveled all the way across the Sea of Galilee trying to get some rest, trying to get some relief, but this mighty multitude had followed him and they had settled in for the evening. So I want you to get the picture. The sun was setting. Stomachs were beginning to growl. Evening was coming because it was supper time. Now listen to verse 1. After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. Then a great multitude followed him because they saw his signs, which he performed on those who were diseased. And Jesus went up on a mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Now there were actually two things that were missing that day, and I don't want you to miss either one of them. Number one, the crowd lacked food. There was this huge crowd. They were on this grassy knoll sitting there before that shiny simmering sea called the Sea of Galilee. John's already told us in verse 10 there were 5,000 men. Matthew tells us there were also women and children. Bible scholars say conservatively in that crowd there was probably somewhere between 15,000 and 20,000 people. Now here's the amazing thing. Jesus knew what they needed before they even knew what they needed. Nobody said they were hungry. Nobody complained because they had no food. But Jesus already knew that they were hungry. Now, the second thing that is incredible is Jesus knew how he was going to meet their need before they even knew they had a need. There are needs you don't even have right now. But Jesus knows you've got them. And at the right time, he will meet them. My Father, who is in heaven, he had a unique gift. My dad had a gift of knowing what I needed sometimes before I knew that I needed it. For example, there were times growing up my dad would say, son, you need a whipping. Now, I didn't know I had that need. That was not a felt need in my life. But my dad somehow sensed that I had that need. And there are going to be times in your life you're going to say, you know, I didn't see that need coming, but Jesus knew it was coming all along. The crowd lacked food. Jesus knew it. But there was another thing that was lacking. Not only did the crowd lack food, the disciples lacked faith. For listen to verse 5. Then Jesus lifted up his eyes and seeing a great multitude coming toward him, said to Philip, where shall we buy bread that these may eat? Now look in verse 6. But this he said to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. He was giving Philip a test. Your years in seminary will be a test. Your life in the ministry will be a test. Your work in the pastorate will be a test. This was a test. And the first person to take the exam was Philip. Now, Jesus asked Philip a rhetorical question. You see, he wasn't really asking Philip where to buy food because he already knew what he was going to do. He was giving Philip a test. And guess what? Philip flunked it royally. Look in verse 7. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may have a little. Now, I want you to notice something. Philip answered a question that Jesus hadn't even asked. Jesus did not ask him how much. He just simply said, where do we go? Philip got out his Palm Pilot, got out his calculator. He begins to figure out, now how much food will it take and how much money will it take? And if you go back and calculate what Jesus was asking him to do in modern day equivalent, it would have cost $20,000 to have fed that crowd. Well, Philip looked at his person, and Philip looked at his purse, and he quickly figured out several things. Number one, in that day there was no Walmart. Number two, his American Express was maxed out. Number three, even if Walmart was open and his credit was good, there was not enough time to go buy the food. Number four, even if he had a credit card, even if Walmart was open, and even if there was enough time, there was not enough time to get all the food that they needed, and everybody would have just gotten a little bit of food. So Philip looked at the size of the multitude. He looked at the sum of the money, shrugged his shoulder and said, impossible. And Philip was what I call a statistical pessimist. He had a slide rule for a mind. And if he couldn't get it in that slide rule, if it wouldn't fit, he said, forget it. You've got people like that, you're going to pastor all of your life. There are always going to be people in your church. And let me tell you something. No matter what you want to lead them to do, here's going to be their first question. How much does it cost? Doesn't matter what good it's going to do. Doesn't matter whether God wants you to do it. Doesn't matter where God provides. They say, what? How much does it cost? And let me just warn you right now. You are always going to have people in your church and in your ministry who will live to figure out why it can't be done. I mean, their spiritual gift is pessimism. In the Los Angeles Times years ago, Barry Siegel wrote an article entitled, The World May End with a Splash. And in that article, he shows just how ridiculous negative thinking can be. Listen to this. Alarmists worrying about such matters as nuclear holocaust and pesticide poisoning may be overlooking much more dire catastrophes. Consider what some scientists predict. If everyone keeps stacking National Geographics in garages and attics instead of throwing them away, the magazine's weight will sink and the continent will go under by 100 feet sometime soon and we'll all be inundated by the oceans. You got to quit buying those books. If the number of microscope specimen slides submitted to one St. Louis hospital laboratory continues to increase at its current rate, that metropolis will be buried under 3 feet of glass by the year 2024. If beachgoers keep returning home with as much sand clinging to them as they do now, 80% of the country's coastline will disappear in 10 years. Listen to this. It has been reported that pickles cause cancer, communism, airline crashes, automobile accidents, and crime waves. 99% of cancer victims have eaten pickles sometime in their life. So have 100% of all soldiers, 96.88% of communist sympathizers, and 99.7% of those involved in car and air accidents. Moreover, those born in 1839 who ate pickles suffered a 100% mortality rate. And rats force-fed 20 pounds of pickle a day for a month end up with bulging abdomens and loss of appetite. You've got people like that. Listen, there are people in your church, they'll be negative and don't even mean to. I had a lady come up to me the other day. She said, you will never know how much your messages have meant to my husband since he lost his mind. They're trying to be positive. They just can't get there. One man came up to me and said, you know, I've learned something about you. I said, what's that? He said, every message you preach is better than the next one. Now, Andrew did a little bit better. While Philip was running his fingers over the calculator, Andrew went off looking for food. Here's what he finds. Look in verse 8. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish, but what are they among so many? Now, he finds a little boy. This little boy has 5 loaves of barley and 2 small fish. He looked at the size of the multitude. He looked at the source of the meal. And where Philip said, impossible, Andrew said, illogical. And both of those men had made one great mistake. And we make it every day of our life. They had calculated without Christ. They had left Jesus out of the equation. They had used that famous phrase we all love to use, humanly speaking. You know what happens so often when we panic? You know what panic is in the Christian life? Panic in the Christian life is when you get under pressure and instead of Jesus becoming your first resource, he becomes your last resort. See, I'm concerned. Jesus was not concerned about the lack of food. Jesus was concerned about the lack of faith. You know why? A lack of food, a lack of money, a lack of this or a lack of that never stops God. But a lack of faith can stop God dead in his tracks. He did not do many miracles there because of their what? Unbelief. It is a lack of faith. And what broke the heart of Jesus in this situation was he had given those disciples every reason to have faith and no reason to have doubt. You go back in the Gospel of John and think back to what those disciples had already seen Jesus do. They had already seen Jesus turn water into wine. They had already seen Jesus heal the nobleman's son. They had already seen Jesus heal a paralytic man, and yet they still needed the faith of a mountain to move a mustard seed. They didn't get it. They still didn't get it. And there are a lot of us that still don't get it. You can look back, every one of you can look back in your life as I can. And you can see how in your life, time after time after time after time, God provided for your need and God met your need. And yet when it comes time and the pressure is on and the worry meter goes up, you still don't get it. I heard about a Sunday school teacher who was trying to illustrate to her boys and girls the dangers of drinking alcohol. So she filled up two glasses, one with water and one with alcohol. She pulled out some earthworms she had dug up. She dropped some of those earthworms into the water. Well, the worms just swam around that water having a great time. Then she took some earthworms and dropped it into the glass of alcohol. And they just curled up and died. She said, "Now, boys and girls, what does this teach you?" And one little boy spoke up and said, "I know what it teaches. If you've got worms, drink alcohol." Now, that is not what the miracle teaches. Here's what the miracle teaches. When you get into those situations you're facing and you think, this is impossible, this won't work, this cannot be done, remember Luke 18:27. The things which are impossible with men are possible with God. You say impossible, not with God. You say illogical. Wait a minute. Isaiah 55:9 says, "As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." What may be ridiculous with you is reasonable with God. So what does pressure do? Number one, it tests our faith in Jesus. Number two, it turns our focus to Jesus. Because even though all four Gospels include this miracle, only John records the little boy who gave his lunch. Now, next to Jesus, the biggest hero in this story is that little boy. You see, that little boy had barely brought enough to feed himself. When you read where it says he had five loaves and two fishes, don't get the idea. Well, they could have fed 15 or 20 people. Loaves, that doesn't mean a loaf of bread like you and I would buy in a grocery store. The word loaf means a wafer. It was just a very small little pancake. And the word fish refers to a little pickled fish like a sardine. It was just enough to feed one little boy. But here's a principle I want you to learn. That little boy was willing to share what he had. If you don't hear anything else I say in this message, I want you to know what I'm about to tell you. Anything you transfer to Jesus can be transformed by Jesus. Anything you transfer to Jesus can be transformed by Jesus. You know, some of you out here are better preachers than others. Some of you out here may be better administrators than others. Some of you out here may be better singers than others. Some of you out here may wind up being better teachers than others. Some of you out here may be better leaders than others. We don't all have equal strengths. We all have certain weaknesses. But I have learned in my own life, anything, whether it's a strength or a weakness, anything I transfer to Jesus can be transformed by Jesus. And what that little boy had was valuable because it was available. And there's something else about that little boy that blesses my heart. 12 grown men looked at Jesus and said, "We can't feed these people." But one little boy looked at Jesus and said, "Lord, I believe you can take what I've got, and I believe you can feed every one of these people." May I tell you something? There is one area that I ask God constantly, "Lord, help me to be just like a little child," and that is the area of faith. You know what's so strange about growing in the Lord? It's really kind of strange. You know, there are Christians who have been Christians for 10 and 20 and 30 years, and yet in a real sense, they have less faith today than they had when they first got saved. And it happens so often that when it comes to faith, sometimes we get too big for our britches. We think, well, you know, if I'll use this technique, if I'll use this church growth concept, if I'll follow this man over here, if I'll do what that guy's doing over here, I can grow my church, I can build this, I can do that. And we leave God totally out of the equation, and faith goes out the window. We ought to be like children. That's why Jesus loved children so much. That's why Jesus said, "Unless you come to me as a little child, you cannot even enter into the kingdom of heaven. I wish I had the faith of a little boy who got into an argument with his sister. There was a brownie, and there was only one brownie that was left, and they got into this big argument who's going to get that last brownie. Well, the mother walked in and overheard them fussing and came in and said, "What are you fussing about?" And they let the mother know that they were fussing over who's going to get this brownie. And her two children, both very upset, they both wanted that last brownie. Well, that mother sensed an opportunity to teach a real deep spiritual truth. So she looked at that little boy, looked at that little girl, and she said, "Now, what would Jesus do?" That little boy said, "Oh, that's easy." He said, "He'd break that brownie and make 5,000 more." Now, we need that kind of faith. We need the kind of faith that understands that if we will put our focus on the Lord, He will come through. And the reason why that little boy had such a strong faith was because he had the right focus. Where the disciples saw a lack, the boy saw the Lord. Where they saw a multitude, he saw a miracle. Where they saw the crowd, he saw Christ. And that's why without equivocation, hesitation, reservation, he gave him his lunch. Now you know what happened. Jesus took the bread, he took the fish, he blessed it, he broke it, he gave it. They fed all of that crowd and they wound up taking up 12 baskets of leftovers. One for every disciple. And that little boy that brought a schoolroom lunch took home a grocery store full of food because of one reason. He focused on Jesus. And that little boy, I guarantee you, learned two lessons that day he never forgot the rest of his life. Number one, never doubt what God can do. Never doubt what God can do. He is in the miracle business. Number two, never deny God whatever God asks you to give Him. He is in the multiplication business. I read a little poem back when I was in the seminary years ago. I'll never forget it. It goes like this. If just a cup of water is all that is in your hand, then just a cup of water is all that I demand. What does pressure do? It tests our faith in Jesus. It turns our focus to Jesus. But here's the last thing it does. It teaches us facts about Jesus. Now, I want you to listen very carefully. Jesus didn't perform this miracle to show that if he wanted to, he could open up a bakery. That was not his concern. There's a deeper lesson to the loaves that runs than just feeding 20,000 people and having 12 baskets of leftover. And if you really want to know the meaning of the miracle, look in verse 14. Then those men, when they had seen the sign that Jesus did, said, "This is truly the prophet who is to come into the world." Do you know what the purpose of that miracle was? It wasn't just to do a magic trick with a bunch of bread and a few fish. It wasn't just to show himself off. It wasn't even just to satisfy the hunger of 20,000 people. It was to illustrate that the bread that Jesus blessed was a picture of Jesus Christ himself. And that's why he said in verse 35, "I am the bread of life." You see, that miracle was not about material bread baked by an earthly mother to meet physical needs. It was about spiritual bread baked by a heavenly Father to meet spiritual needs. And the whole point of that miracle was not to feed the stomachs of those people. It was to force them to turn to the one who could feed their soul. Jesus did not perform this miracle just to satisfy physical hunger, just to slake spiritual, physical thirst. He did it to make the people spiritually hungry and spiritually thirsty and to show them that He was the bread of life and He was the living water. It was more than just a Passover picnic, because notice what He goes on to say in verse 25. And when they found Him on the other side of the sea, they said to Him, "Rabbi, when did you come here?" Jesus answered them and said, "Most assuredly I say to you, you seek me not because you saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and you were filled. Do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because the Father has set His seal on Him." You see, they never really did understand. Jesus said, "Listen, I didn't come here to keep your stomach from growling. I came here to keep your soul from perishing." You notice it says in verse 12, they were filled. That is, they were satisfied. Where once they were hungry, now they were no longer hungry. Once they were thirsty, now they were no longer thirsty. They didn't want anything else to eat. They didn't want anything else to drink. They were totally satisfied. But here's what I want you to see. They would have not been filled, and they would have gone away hungry except for Jesus Christ. Now remember this. Nobody could eat another bite. There were 12 baskets left over, and I'm sure Jesus said, "Does anybody want anything else?" And I mean, all you could hear was burping. Nobody wanted anything else. They said, "We are full." And what's the point? I've been saved for 41 years. Jesus means more to me at this moment in my life than He's ever meant in my life. I've never been closer to Jesus than I am at this moment in my life. Let me tell you what I've learned about Jesus. Jesus is not only all that you need. He is more than you need. There is not a problem you have that Jesus cannot solve. There's not a hunger you have that Jesus cannot satisfy. There's not a thirst you have that Jesus cannot meet. There's not a hurt you have that Jesus cannot heal. There's not a question you have that Jesus cannot answer. That's why when the pressure is really on, if you know the Lord Jesus, you ought to already know, "Lord, there's not a pressure I'll face in my life, face in my marriage, face in my ministry, face in my family, that you and I cannot meet together." I got to go to Israel my last time, maybe the last time I'll ever get to go, 2 years ago. We flew into Egypt and we took a bus ride, an 8-hour bus ride across the Sinai Desert from Egypt over to Israel. And I got to thinking about how Moses led the people out of the children of Israel. And I want you to just think about this as I close my message. I want you to go back to that time when Moses was charged with the responsibility of leading the people of Israel out of Egypt. Let me ask you a question. You think Moses felt any pressure when God said, "I want you to lead all these people out of here"? You think he felt any pressure at all? They had to be fed. And in order to feed them, Moses would have had 1,500 tons of food every day. Now, do you know what it would take to bring that much food every day? 2 freight trains a mile long would be required. Now, wait a minute. They're out in the desert. They'd have to have firewood to use in cooking the food. This would take 4,000 tons of wood, which would be a few more freight trains, each one a mile long. Wait a minute. They were 40 years in the wilderness. They had to have water. If they only had enough to drink and wash a few dishes, it would take 11 million gallons every day, and a freight train with tank cars 1,800 miles long just to bring the water. Then another thing, they had to get across the Red Sea at night. Now, if they went on a narrow path, double file, the line would be 800 miles long and would require 35 days a night to get through. So there had to be a space in the Red Sea 3 miles wide so they could walk 5,000 abreast to get over in one night. But there's another problem. Every time they camped at the end of the day, a campground two-thirds the size of the state of Rhode Island was required, 750 square miles. Now, I want to ask you a question. You think Moses had all that figured out before he left Egypt? I'll guarantee you he didn't. But I'll tell you what he did do. He believed in God. He trusted the Lord. And God took care of every one of those needs. So here's the question I want to ask you. Do you think God has any problem meeting your needs? There was a lady that came up to her pastor and she said, "Pastor, I want to ask you a question." She said, "I know that God cares about the big things in my life. Do you think God cares about the little things in my life?" The pastor looked at that lady and said, "Before I can answer your question, I've got to ask you a question." She said, "What's that?" He said, "Can you tell me anything in your life that's big to God? Can you?" A God that spoke, and this beautiful world that my president talked about came into existence. Do you think you've got anything big to God? As you leave this place and go out into this world, some to country churches, some to urban churches, some to foreign lands, some to receptive people, some to unreceptive people, some to fertile ground, some to rocky ground, some to more easy ministries, some to more difficult ministries. The next time you see a loaf of bread or the next time you see a fish, you remember this. There is nothing impossible with God. Lord, in the name of Jesus, bless these precious students and use them for your glory and for your honor. And as they come under the everyday pressure of ministry, and that's what ministry is all about, as they come under everyday pressures that come in our life, Lord, help them remember, pressure tests our faith in Jesus. Pressure turns our focus to Jesus. And pressure teaches us facts about Jesus, which is, most of all, we can cast our care upon Him because He cares for us. And it's in His name we pray.